It was great to hear certain aspects of both Dan and Chris's presentation, one being the real focus that Dan had on population health, and the other being kind of the caveats that Chris had at the end of what do we do with this. And I just wanted to start with a little bit of a warning. Okay, so in these sessions, because of, you know, being from Jersey and having to deal with real epidemiology and public health, sometimes I'm the person that has to ground truth things. And I think it's important that we ground truth things. So a little story. So in 1977, when the Ames test emerged, it was really seen as a promising way to try and understand things, particularly related to environmental chemicals. And New Jersey at that time was in the midst of a real public health crisis, having the highest cancer rates in the country and having many cancers that were clearly associated with environmental and occupational exposures, where our counties had nation-leading rates, all the 3,000 counties. So I was convinced by a group of academics to conduct the Ames test on our major surface water supplies, major public water supplies, Trenton, Passaic Water Company, Hackensack Valley, and they were all positive. All right, in multiple strains, we have mutations. And then I had to go to the governor's office and try to explain this. And the question becomes, okay, you got the answer. What's the question? So it's through that lens that I chair the Silver Book Committee, that I try to approach risk assessment, because it's a very important tool to inform decisions, right? And that's very different from research. So as we look at the future of risk assessment, I think that's important. So anyhow, the questions that were posed was, will systems biology, toxicogenomics, and the next generation assessments really improve public health? Can we apply these tools to identify hazards? And most importantly, perhaps, what are the other tools? And I think Chris mentioned that there's a continuum of tools that we must have to make this really interpretable and to have its impact. So first I want to talk about the public health approach. And Dan talked about this very nicely in his REACT, because population health, it's very different. I mean, there's lots of criticisms now about reductionist science and risk assessment, and can we really address environmental health one molecule at a time, or don't we have to talk about bigger systems environmental health? So the public health approach really contrasts with the regulatory approach that we've kind of evolved into. So Lauren, you can't gesture up here. You can't be from Jersey. You know what I'm talking about? All right, So this public health approach, as Dan explained very nicely, I think it really does consider much more than just that compound, that molecule, but the agent factors, the host factors, and the environmental factors. That's the epidemiological triad. And our goal is really the prevention of disease, not prediction of the number of adverse effects we're going to see in a population. So if you think about risk assessment, the arguments we have about one in a million and which one is the benchmark dose and the point of departure. We also focus on, clearly, and this has been such an argument with risk-based policies, whether we should have additional protections for children and things like that, we focus on the susceptible and vulnerable populations. Do any outbreak investigation, you'll find out who's most vulnerable. And it's our kids and it's our elderly, whether it's E. coli or whether it's a chemical exposure. We have less emphasis on those bright lines and acceptable risk and more emphasis on eliminating risk. So a classic example, and this is a microbial example, so it's not entirely fair, but if this were a pesticide exposure issue, perhaps in melons, that actually California had some experience with. But so if we know that cantaloupes, for instance, just to take an abstract example, are contaminated, we remove them from the store. All right. We don't study how many pieces of cantaloupe, how many cantaloupes you can eat before you get ill. All right. And that's kind of what we do in risk assessment. All right. And we understand that we really have to make sure that the nursing homes and the daycare centers don't have this cantaloupe. And we look at the susceptible and the most highly exposed. So that's kind of a fundamental difference in the way we look at things. And so Now, how does this relate to the promise of next-gen risk assessment and toxicogenomics? Well, if you read most of the work of tox testing, the next-gen risk papers, there's a caveat there that we have a long way to go. And there's a window of 10 to 20 years. I don't have 20 years to give, 20 more years to give in my career. Maybe, but I doubt it. I'm from Jersey. So how can we move toward applications now? And we have these emerging kinds of indicators. So I'd like to, Kruski always puts his books up, so I have to put the silver book up for me and Lauren. So let's look through the lens of the silver book, which actually Joe Rodericks and John Levy, both on the committee, are kind of looking at. Is there a tension between tox testing and the silver book as we move kind of to big picture solutions versus single substance risk assessments? And I don't think there is. All right. So first, the major public health themes of the silver book are one, and this is fundamental to every problem-solving approach we teach in public health. It's fundamental to what we do in public health. First, you got to know what question you're answering. All right, a detailed formulation of the problem, answering the right question. Ecological risk assessments do this. EPA guidelines for microbial risk assessment. It's very fundamental, but frankly, in a lot of chemical risk assessments, we start with hazard identification, and we haven't done this. So we have to ask the right questions. We focus on susceptibility and population variability in the work in the Silver Book. We got in a little hot water about a unified approach to dose response assessment, which some felt we were advocating that things really don't have thresholds. I'll let you think about that one and supply your own science to prove to me that there are thresholds for many things. But we also talked about the reality of cumulative risk assessment. If you look at Dan's approach to public health and the agent-host environment interaction, cumulative risk assessment really has to be the future of risk assessment. We also talked about improving the utility to focus on problems and stakeholder involvement. Well, how do we get to stakeholder involvement when we're talking about toxicogenomics? So I actually have to borrow Kruski's slide because he put it together a lot nicer than this beast. This is from the Silver Book. And so there's three phases we talked about. I talked about problem formulation and asking the right questions, knowing what the problem is, and beginning to line up potential solutions. The conduct of the risk assessment, which is very much in line with the Red Book and the traditional approach to hazard identification, but also has a step of confirming that this is actually useful. All right. So a lot of risk assessments kind of end with numbers and forget to go back to the questions and say, well, is this what we really needed? Is this slope factor going to answer anything? Or is it going to get us in hot water in congressional hearings? So... And then, obviously, risk management is a big part of science and decisions. And so looking through these steps, I mean, how do we tackle some of these? And probably the biggest problem that we had in our debates and deliberations in the Silver Book was the biggest problem in risk assessment, and that is what's happening down at those lower ends of the dose response curve. And so think about Chris's presentation. Think about the work that is going on at the cellular level, with systems biology and with computational tox. And there's a tremendous potential for us to understand mechanisms and perturbations that may very well enlighten us on this lower end. So it's no longer a theological debate among elected official, but it's actually backed up by better weight of evidence of what's going on at low dose. It will also enlighten us on that age-old problem of really, the population is not a single population, and there's tremendous variability in the population and susceptibility. And if you take a look at this graph, obviously, we want to protect the susceptible subgroups, right? Well, will this research, will next-gen risk assessment, will toxicogenomics and systems biology help us with that? Absolutely. Absolutely. But we need answers, all right? So when I was appointed to the Board of Environmental Studies at the National Academy, you have to kind of stand up and make remarks. And at that time, I think I was still a state official. And I said, my goal is being active in the Academy is that more state officials sitting in gray cubicles will actually use this stuff. that's been my goal in general in risk assessment. And so the big question is, so what are these perturbations, what are these cellular level responses, what are these CHIP indicators mean for population health? Many of us who have been involved in many of the debates about risk assessment and tried to set standards, tried to make decisions, understand that NOEL and how important it is, or that benchmark dose. And the NOEL used to be the N-O-E-L, you know, like Christmas time, and then we put that A in there, that adverse effect. Can we really understand that these perturbations are adverse effects for the human population? That's the $64,000 question, which the elderly here will understand that that used to be a TV show. That's right. Now that's a low starting salary for an MPH. And will they provide the basis for the dose response and risk characterization? So I was enlightened and happy that Chris was beginning to show that consistency in dose response for certain endpoints, and clearly there's promise there. Do they predict actual health outcomes in the population? Kind of like the Ames test and the Hackensack Water Company. I don't think we're there yet. And perhaps most importantly, and several of us in this room have felt the heat of elected officials, state health commissioners, our colleagues, saying, well, can we really make decisions based on this? And will they be accepted by stakeholders? If we think the epidemiological evidence for arsenic, for chromium 6, is under attack right now, just imagine presenting omics data and trying to make a $1 billion decision on that. So this is the road ahead. So the reality check here. Well, so this stuff is pretty far removed from the cubicles. Right, we have to make it understandable. Actually, I'm very optimistic. Once we do the translation, it's a really good part of the weight of evidence and the continuum of public health that we do. Professionals in public health and the public, particularly the public, don't have a clue right now what all this omic stuff means. All right. And we have a responsibility to begin that translation now. Besides, and here at APHA, you can get the vibe. Much of the public health community hasn't really bought into quantitative risk assessment and the work we use in regulatory risk. So many of my environmental health director colleagues, the folks day-to-day making decisions, they don't like this risk assessment stuff. And they don't deal in one substance at a time. When the water's contaminated, they shut it off, or they take the melons off the shelf, right? So, and this 20-year time frame, pretty hard to sell. It is, especially to people who are elected 2 years at a time. You know what I mean? Okay, so what about stakeholders? Right now, the credibility of environmental science is being questioned really like never before. So we are at a crossroads methodologically. But stakeholders from all sides of the table are questioning things, and decision makers. There's increasing criticism and questioning of the validity of animal testing and human data, as I mentioned. We have to do the outreach. We have to address the concerns. We have to be working now to formulate the problem. Okay, getting back to that public health approach, because as Chris mentioned, the expectations need to be realistic. Overselling is a bad thing, as Bruce Ames. So, what are the possibilities? Well, there are near-term applications, and I'd like to talk about them. I think the next generation risk assessment, the work coming out of our laboratories on the omics, is really important for problem formulation. We can help identify the issues, the critical public health endpoints, begin to understand the mechanisms. It will help in hazard identification. It will really reinforce, as I think I forget the name of it, but I got to get that slide. The interactome, that's so cool. I got to figure out my own home. will help us know the disease endpoints of concern and those where the environmental connection is strongest, and help us with weight of evidence. Now, the other side of this is there's lots of future research that has to be done. Dose response assessment, identification of susceptibles, linkages to actual disease and getting to causality, and that whole policy connection. And then I would be remiss here at APHA if I didn't talk about the emergence of health impact assessment. Health impact assessment, I think, is the sister ship to risk assessment as we move forward in our methods of combining population health, as Dan talked about, and risk assessment. And it has the potential to augment risk assessment, to ground truth, and to help environmental health surveillance throughout the practice of public health. So, are we there yet? No. We have a lot of work to do. But I don't think it's 10 to 20 years. I think we can begin to apply things right now in weight of evidence, in formulating the questions, in outreach, in working with the public health community. It's great to have this meeting here, and not just at SOT, but at APHA. Gaining acceptance and moving beyond research to practice will take that kind of effort that I talked about to demonstrate the utility of things and define their limitations. But, as Dan again said, omics will not replace the need for exposure science. The biomarkers of exposure, continued support for the biomonitoring efforts of the National Center for Environmental Health, and traditional exposure pathway monitoring will be important. But I think the tox testing report, the Silver Book, the health impact report, which I recommend to all of you out of the National Academy most recently, and the next generation framework will really be important to public health practitioners in the future. So the bottom line is we are at those crossroads. We desperately need new tools. One molecule at a time is not going to solve environmental health. The next generation of toxicity testing can provide that bridge between the risk-based regulatory approach and the prevention-based public health approach. The promise is great, but the challenges are there too. So I'll stop with that. Thank you.